From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
China, the environment, and the future of coal in America. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The U.S. is getting greener as coal is replaced by natural gas, which is cleaner and cheaper, but that doesn't mean the coal industry is going away. Massive coal deposits on federal land in Wyoming and Montana have already been leased to companies with plans for export to China. That's created furious opposition to mile-long coal trains and entire new ports proposed for construction on the Pacific coast. What would it mean for local pollution and global warming? Will the principal benefits go to the public or the coal industry? On Reporter's Notebook later on, a new book is creating another stir about Scientology. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. With a declining market for coal in the United States, the coal industry wants to export its product to China, where demand is bigger than ever. What would new rail traffic and new port construction mean for the environment and the clean economy of the Pacific Northwest? What about global warming? On Reporter's Notebook, the Church of Scientology is taking a hit from a new book it calls False and Unsupportable. We'll hear from the author. First, this news update. In Egypt, on the second anniversary of the ouster of Hosni Mubarak, Tahrir Square in Cairo is full of protesters against his successor. David Kirkpatrick is Cairo bureau chief for the New York Times, familiar voice on our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Describe the scene there.
Well, Tahrir Square is indeed full of protests, but the scene is bigger than that. Really, spots of chaos have erupted across Egypt tonight. There are big clouds of tear gas just off Tahrir Square, outside the television building, outside the presidential palace. I hear a crackle of gunfire in the distance here by the Nile, and I understand there's been an attack on at least one Muslim Brotherhood office that I've seen. As well as reportedly some others in provinces around the country. There have been clashes all over the place. I mean, contained in each city. You know, they're localized. They're attacking a party office or a local government building. But it's everywhere. You know, it's really quite chaotic.
What are their grievances?
You know, I have been working hard to figure that out, and it is difficult to pin down. I would say they come in two baskets. The first is this revolution has not yet lived up to expectations. You know, the slogan was bread, freedom, and social justice. The economy has, in fact, tanked. Things for most people are in many ways worse than they were, if only because the tourism has dried up and there's been so much chaos. So people are unhappy and disappointed. The other basket is a real hatred of the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, it's a funny situation here. The Muslim Brotherhood, Egypt's largest Islamist group, has really dominated the elections. They've done very well whenever Egyptians go to the ballot box. And yet there is a passionate segment of society that just can't believe they won, that suspects the Brotherhood of being sort of closet terrorists and radicals at heart, and is just driven nuts by the idea that they now control the presidency and the parliament.
Is this all about religion, then, or something much more complicated than that?
It's both simpler and more complicated. You know, everybody here is religious. You'll never see somebody who says, I'm an atheist or secular. It's more about the organization. You know, the Brotherhood was a very insular, defensive organization that survived underground while outlawed for 60 years. And during that time, a pretty broad breach opened up between the organization and the rest of the society, which was sort of making peace more or less with the secular autocracy here and the world economy. And so there's a lot, there's a deep, deep, deep mistrust on both sides. I mean, the Brotherhood is certainly paranoid, and nights like this do nothing to change that. And at the same time, some of the Brotherhood's paranoia, you know, their defensiveness, their reliance on themselves and each other, creeps everybody else out. So it's going to take a while for this to get resolved here, I think.
What about President Morsi? Has he been heard from?
He has not been heard from today, to my knowledge, but I've been kind of in the thick of it. So if he went on television the last few minutes, I wouldn't know about it. He spoke last night, which also happened to be the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad, and he said a few words urging people to come out and protest, express themselves in a way consistent with their new freedoms, but respect state institutions and avoid violence. And that has not quite happened.
So is this something that you think will go on for a few days, or is it likely to end soon? What about the army?
That's a very good question. The army has stayed out of it. You know, one of the reasons why there have been so many clashes tonight and so much tear gas is the army left things in the hands of the police. The Egyptian police, let me just say it, they are terrible at crowd control. Protesters get together and they start throwing rocks at a phalanx of police. The officers here throw the rocks back, I kid you not, which does nothing to disperse the crowd but only inflames it. And then they add tear gas into the mix, but in a kind of sporadic way that, again, does nothing to disperse the crowd but only inflames it. The army, frankly, is better at crowd control. So the army's taken a step back, saying we're going to get out of politics, we're no longer controlling the streets, we're going to leave it to the elected officials. Some of the protesters I've talked to actually have said, we are out to create so much chaos that the army has to come back, that the army will kick President Morsi out of power. But I've got to believe that's a minority view.
All right. We will see then how long this goes on. In the meantime, David Kirkpatrick in the thick of it in Tahrir Square in Cairo, a bureau chief there for The New York Times. Thanks so much for being on our program again.
It's a pleasure.
In a moment, China, the environment, and the future of coal in America on To The Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Worman Olney back with To The Point. Faced with environmental restrictions and cheap natural gas, America's coal industry could be in trouble. Its salvation might lie in exports to China. Massive deposits on public land in Wyoming and Montana have been leased to coal companies who want to build a vast new infrastructure on the pristine coast of the Pacific Northwest. Joel Connolly is a columnist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Joel Connolly, good to have you on our show.
Good morning.
That's not the only thing that people are complaining about, I take it, the building of new ports. Give us the background of this, if you will, and tell us how much of an uproar there's been about it.
I went to a hearing earlier this month to scope out the environmental impact statement. Scoping out EISs is not the sort of thing that generally draws a big crowd, but 2,500 people packed into the Seattle Convention Center's took up two meeting rooms. You had people dressed up as polar bears, people dressed up as salmon. I would say about 95% of the people were there were opposed to the coal port, and opposed to it on a number of reasons, mainly environmental, but also potential economic and transportation impacts. I can look out the window of where I work, and I look right down on the railroad tracks, which are just in from a working waterfront.
So there would be then an impact of this in Seattle, but the entire process would start in Montana and Wyoming, then work its way down the Columbia River, as I understand it, then up the coast, and finally to a port near Bellingham, which is almost on the Canadian border.
Yeah, it's the town in which I grew up. Just north of the border at near Tsawwassen in British Columbia, there is a great big Canadian coal export port, something that should be seen by anybody who is a connoisseur of ugliness. It has caused environmental impacts done very sloppily and so on. So people say in the Bellingham area can look north and see something that they don't like. But all up this pristine coastline, you have working ports. You have the railroad going just inland. But you also have the wider apprehension. And this has been fed by the studies of the University of Montana with economist Dr. Thomas Power, that all of this coal, all of the 18 mile and a half long trains a day, would essentially be exported to China, and since it is relatively inexpensive, would have the impact of allowing China's older and dirtier power plants to extend their lives. And China is now, of course, the world's leading emitter of greenhouse gases.
So there's a lot of complications to this, and not just involving the United States. Let's hear a bit of that meeting that you were talking about. First, here's what a train engineer had to tell the crowd.
For three decades, we've been hauling coal through one of the largest natural or wetlands in the United States, in central Nebraska. And there's never been any problem with coal dust or acidification of the waterways or any of these problems that everybody's talking about.
Okay, the train engineer obviously responding to some of the complaints that have been made. And here is the mayor of Bellingham, Washington.
Right now we have a very controversial issue in Whatcom County, and that is the development of the pier at Cherry Point. I am strong enough to have my personal opinions. I do not support a dedicated coal pier.
So, Joel Connolly, back to you. Are politicians to a certain extent caught here between various different interests, because the engineer and others who would be involved in the coal development and transportation would benefit from it?
We have two of the basic core constituencies of the Democratic Party pitted against each other. The construction unions, the longshoremen, they want this. And carried much of organized labor with them. The King County Labor Council was present at this hearing to argue in favor of it. By contrast, the environmentalists are fervently opposed to this. So you have a situation where Kelly Linville, the mayor of Bellingham, is critical and opposed to it. Congressman Rick Larson, the Democrat from Northwest Washington, is supportive of it. Seattle's mayor, Mike McGinn, and most of our local officials are passionately against it. The newly elected governor finds himself basically with a role in the environmental impact statement and keeping his head down.
Joel Connolly again, now columnist at the SeattlePI.com. Lori Hennessy is a spokesperson for the Alliance for Northwest Jobs and Exports. That's a coalition of coal companies and rail operators and unions and business groups supporting the construction of the new ports. Ms. Hennessy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
How big a port are we talking about, and how many new ports are we talking about?
You know, there's a variety of proposals on the table right now. Five sites are now under consideration. They're all at different levels in the process. The main site that people are talking about now, like Joel said, is up in Whatcom County on the border of Washington State. It's called the Gateway Pacific Terminal. But all of the sites are in different places on the timeline. And our organization came together about 6 months ago to represent, you know, a growing number of everything from businesses to trade, labor unions, and elected officials and others who support the idea and want to come together to help it.
How do you respond to the complaints that have been made by the environmentalists that this will involve, as we heard from Joel Connolly, 8 mile and a half long trains, 18 of them a day, coming down the Columbia River, going up the coast, and the construction of new ports that might be as ugly, unattractive, and likely to pollute as the one just over the border in Canada?
You know, I guess I would say to that the people in the Northwest, one of the things that unite people in the Northwest is that we love the environment. And I do believe that you can support these projects and be an environmentalist, because for a couple of reasons. One is that we are going to build the projects the right way. There's a reason that we have environmental impact statements. And the reason that those exist is to tell us where the areas of concern are so we can then mitigate those areas. So all we're asking at this point is let the federal government guide us and tell us what we need to work on. And the other thing I would say in response to what Joel said is, you know, We have several polls, including one from Public Broadcasting, that says 56% of the people in the region actually support this. There are a lot of people who support it. So while these hearings turn out people who have pretty strong feelings, yes, on one side, there are a lot of people out there who think it's a good idea.
Lori Hennessy again with the Alliance for Northwest Jobs and Exports. Casey Golden is Policy Director at Climate Solutions. That's a clean economy organization based in the Northwest, part of the Power Past Coal Coalition of environmental organizations and other local groups that oppose the port developments and the increased exports. Casey Golden, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Do you dispute the idea that these can be built in the right way, as Lori Hennison just said?
I do indeed, and even before I dispute that, our primary concern is what happens to the coal when it's burned and how that disrupts the global climate. And this would be a major new link in the chain of commercial transactions that feed climate disruption, which is already reaching crisis proportions. So that is our primary concern. We are also very, very concerned with what it does to these communities. You know, the economic benefits, what sparse economic benefits there are, happen in the terminal communities, but in communities all along the railroad tracks, including little ones like Washougal, Washington, and big ones like Seattle, we've just got train traffic coming through all day. All we get is noise, impact, dust, congestion, and there's no economic benefit at all.
What about what we just heard from that engineer who says they've been hauling coal all over the United States for a long period of time, and it's worked out quite well?
There are some disputes about where and when the dust occurs. It's very clear that there's a lot of it in the terminal communities and a lot of it at one end of the line. We don't know yet how much happens in the communities along the way. We know for sure that this would cause a lot of congestion on our freight corridors, crowding out higher value commerce that creates more jobs, more economic activity, and healthier communities in the Northwest. It also would have huge impacts on the Puget Sound. Puget Sound is a very valuable and fragile ecosystem in the Northwest, and we're talking about crowding that with these giant mega freighters coming in several each day with tremendous impacts to the health and vitality of Puget Sound and our fishing industry.
We're going to talk about the global impact of this in a few moments. I want to go back to Lori Hennessy, get her to respond to what we just heard with regard to the giant ships and the enormous number of trains. Respond, if you will. Let's start with the trains.
You know, in terms of the trains, one of the partners that we're working with is BNSF, and we also work with Union Pacific. And Burlington Northern and Union Pacific are very closely involved with this. And these are organizations that have for decades worked the rails. They know how to plan for growth, and they know how to make it happen in a way that supports the economy. And they're going to address this and make sure it does not do what some of the opponents are saying it's going to do. Some of the claims are pretty exaggerated, in my opinion.
What about the big ships in Puget Sound?
There will be, you know, an addition of ships, but, you know, again, if you have ships off in the water and you know they're there, does it matter what's on those ships? A lot of opponents are trying to scare people in coastal communities by talking about these big ships. I mean, the fact is that's part of trade, and our region is still struggling to get on its feet, and most people that we talk to say that that's a sign of growth for our region if we do export out of the Northwest.
Joel Connolly, back to you at SeattlePI.com. What about the poll that was referred to earlier by Lori Hennessy showing 56% of the people in the area support these projects? Are there others who other polls showing different things, or does it appear that there's general support for the project?
I'm going to straddle the middle on the question of the poll. First of all, it was done by the Davis Hibbets firm in Portland, which is absolutely first-rate pollster, the best that we have in the region. At the same time, however, things that sometimes look good initially develop opposition as people delve into them. Up in Bellingham, again, the place that I grew up, initially it appeared that the developers of the Gateway Pacific Terminal had all of their ducks in a row. Legislators and community leaders, a really distinguished community leader has fronted for the project up there, and labor and business support. But at the same time, again, a spontaneous opposition grew up. And when I went to a Bellingham City Club forum on this, I arrive at the usual place on Northwest Avenue. I can't find a parking place for blocks, and there's literally lines of people snaking around the building, and ultimately they stuffed in 350 people, and the fire marshal had to turn the rest of them away. And these were people who had come late to the issue and had developed reservations. So I think if they were to send Tim Hibbetts back out in the field now, they might find some somewhat different findings.
Describe the area at Cherry Point where the new port would be built, or one of the new ports would be built. That's near the San Juan Islands. Our listeners may be familiar with those as a great tourist attraction. I guess Orcas Island, the largest of them, is right across from Cherry Point.
It is a large industrial area. It has two refineries, or distilleries, as Senator Warren Magnuson once erroneously referred to them, and a great big aluminum plant. There is room for a fourth facility. In the past, various things like an oil derrick facility that would have wiped out herring spawning grounds and so on have been proposed there. So there is room, and this is very definitely an industrial area designed to provide family wage jobs. Nonetheless, all of the big bulk carriers would have to go through Rosario and Haro Straits. There is no requirement that they have a tug escort, such as the case with the oil tankers that ply these waters. They would cross major ferry routes for both British Columbia ferries and Washington State ferries. And also we have the potential situation that the trains would come up right next to the Edmonds-Kingston ferry dock, or the ferry dock in Edmonds, one of the busiest routes in the Sound and one that carries 4 million people a year. So there is worry about people getting to the ferries that go to the San Juan Islands and go to our islands, as well as the big bulk carriers going through two straits that are currently plied by oil tankers.
So, Laurie Hennessy, back to you, Alliance for Northwest Jobs and Exports. What about this? It's an industrial area, and yet it might also cause a good deal of congestion in that very pristine, if I can use that word again, the waterways there between the San Juan Islands.
You know, one of the things that, and I hate to drill down on this again, but, you know, the fact is that we have an environmental impact statement that's supposed to be helping us have this conversation. And I hear what Joel is saying, but ever since we first created the National Environmental Policy Act, environmentalists everywhere have been praising the fact that there's an EIS that tells us how to look at an impact. That's all we're doing now. We're looking at the very things that Joel has raised, seeing if there's a concern, and then we'll be told what the concerns are. Right now, environmentalists in the Northwest are whipping themselves into a frenzy, and some of the people on the fringe are getting pretty upset about a lot of exaggerated claims. All we're saying is, let's put it on the table and talk about it.
Very quickly, Casey Golden with Climate Solutions. We only have a moment before we need to go to a break, but isn't there a dispute about what the scope of the environmental impact statement should be?
Exactly. And we believe that all of the relevant impacts, including the catastrophic climate disruption that results from burning coal and the increase in coal in the global economy, need to be considered. If the proponents believe that these impacts don't exist, then they should have no objection to us examining them in the environmental impact statement. So, indeed, let's get everything on the table.
So at the moment, they don't want to talk about global warming. What about the impacts elsewhere besides at the new port terminals?
Right. In the train corridor all along the route from Montana through Spokane, through the Columbia River Gorge, we believe all those impacts need to be considered. The impact to land values along the rail corridor, there appears to be a huge impact to anybody living near all of the noise and disruption along these rail corridors. And again, in those communities, there are no compensating economic benefits.
Okay. We're going to return in a moment. As I indicated, we'll talk a bit more about the global warming aspects of this, and we'll also get a response from Laurie Hennessy to what we just heard. On Reporter's Notebook later, the author of a new book is creating a stir about the Church of Scientology. We'll hear more about that, and we'll be back in a moment again with To the Point from PRI.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Warman, I'll be back with To the Point, talking today about the uproar that's been created in Washington State by the plan to bring coal mined on public land in Wyoming and Montana by rail down the Columbia River to the Pacific Coast and then up through Seattle to a new port to be constructed near the Canadian border. A lot of things going along the way, according to Casey Golden of Climate Solutions, a clean economy organization. I want to go back to Laurie Hennessy of the Alliance for Northwest Jobs and Exports. You said earlier that you have an environmental impact a statement that's supposed to deal with issues, but it's my understanding that you've wanted it to be focused only on those areas where the new ports are going to be built and not on the areas described by Casey Golden earlier along the way.
You know, every project, when you develop an environmental impact statement, within that asks for a cumulative review of the effects of that project. So I believe that an EIS that's on this project will look at the cumulative review. Now, the question is, some of the people on the other side are saying that they want this broad-scale, sweeping review of the entire region. That's unprecedented. We've never looked at any project in that way. It's like looking at a Boeing airplane part and saying you're going to look at every town that that goes through on the train. We believe it's a stall tactic, and we think that the EIS is going to be cumulative in what it looks at for this project.
What do you mean by a cumulative review if it doesn't cover all of the places that are affected?
Well, that's right now what the Corps of Engineers and our State Department of Ecology are looking at, is what does cumulative mean? All we're saying is that this repeated request for going very broad, looking across an entire region, has never happened before.
Joel Connolly, back to you, SeattlePI.com. What's the record of the Army Corps of Engineers and others that are going to be evaluating this?
They have a crucial role. There is a very crucial role in terms of scoping just how broad this is going to be. For instance, Seattle is doing its own independent studies of what the economic and transportation impacts of this will be. I worry, for instance, and I think this is a legitimate thing to look at. We have, for instance, one Seattle fire unit on the waterfront, one truck, and I think a couple of fireboats. The department has been worried for many, many years about there being a conflagration that would require multiple units at the waterfront. If you had the access to the waterfront blocked by a mile, mile and a half long coal train, well, they're worried about the rail traffic as is. I think this is a legitimate thing to bear into the impact of what a project like this would have. So I think an argument can be made, and not simply by environmental extremists and so on, but by rational city council members and city government and a rational fire department, for a study of somewhat broad scope.
So, Laurie Hennessy, is that better than a stall tactic?
You know, I understand what Joel's saying, and I understand there are very difficult questions here that we're all looking at. What I'm saying is that it all comes down to, what does that broad scope mean? And the requests that we've been hearing have been pretty far-reaching. They have nothing to do with the project, and I do believe they are a stall tactic. But there are a lot of questions we're all sorting through. It's a complicated issue.
Okay, a lot of issues, obviously, none of which we will resolve on this program. But one of them raised by Casey Golden of Climate Solutions has to do with the global warming once the coal goes to China and is burned there. Frank Wallach is a professor of economics and director of the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be on.
You have studied the situation and come up with conclusions that seem to some to be counterintuitive, that actually burning the coal in China, because of the type of coal that it is, might have a beneficial effect rather than the reverse. Can you explain your findings?
Sure. The basic idea is that China is essentially consuming all the coal that it can get. It uses primarily only, it has no ability to switch from burning coal to, say, other fossil fuels such as natural gas in its electricity mix. It only has hydroelectric energy and nuclear power, as well as a little bit of renewables. So it's going to take all of the energy it can get from those sources. And the remaining remainder is therefore going to be made up from coal burning power plants that they have, and the energy demand in China is growing extremely rapidly, growing so rapidly that in many instances they're not even running the scrubbers on their coal-fired power plants because of a desire to get so much power out. So what this really creates is the simple situation that is China is going to burn the coal that it's going to burn to keep the lights on, regardless of where it gets this coal from. And so if it gets this coal from the United States, although that it has a potentially beneficial climate impact, which we're already seeing, which is more coal that is being exported out of the United States is likely to increase the price of coal in the United States. The United States is different from China in the sense that it has the ability to switch away from coal. Historically, we consumed 50% of our electricity was generated from coal as a result of the fact that the price of coal relative to the price of natural gas has fallen, or is price of natural gas has fallen. We're now consuming probably a little less than 35% of our electricity is being generated with coal, and that's largely because, and that would only be exacerbated if more coal left the United States and bid up the price in the United States.
So, in other words, then the price of coal in the United States might rise, or is likely to rise, I gather, because of the natural gas, and yet we're not burning it here. It's being burned in China. Is there also a question about the quality of the coal that's being exported?
Well, the other is that this would be actually, I think, a climate benefit to not a climate benefit, but certainly a local environmental benefit to China, in particular that the Powder River Basin coal, which currently essentially travels by rail to places in the United States as far as New England, in Maine, and in Florida, has been doing so for quite some time. That coal is extremely low sulfur coal, and whereas the coal that it's likely to displace in China would be significantly higher. Higher sulfur, so there is also a local environmental benefit that is likely to accrue to China from the fact that they're burning, if you like, lower sulfur U.S. coal rather than sort of the coal that they're getting domestically, as well as from other sources that they might get.
Okay, the Powder River Basin is the part of Montana and Wyoming where the coal is located on public lands. Casey Golden with Climate Solutions, back to you on this. Is there then potentially and perhaps paradoxically a benefit to this?
We don't believe so. And Warren, if I may, I have a sort of an economic response to the professor's argument and an ethical one. And I'd like to start with the ethical one because it really is an important context, I think, for this discussion. We are in a full-tilt climate crisis now. People are still digging out from the wreckage of Superstorm Sandy. Many people's lives were lost. Many more were disrupted. Half the counties in the U.S. were declared disaster areas because of drought. In Australia last week, the temperature reached 130 degrees, and people literally had to shelter their kids in the ocean to protect them from tornadoes of fire. So these consequences are now upon us, and if we have any hope of responding in a rational and moral way to this crisis, we have to dramatically reduce coal and oil use in the U.S. and around the world. In the Northwest, in fact, we are reducing our coal use. That's part of why they're seeking these Asian markets, is because the market in the U.S. is drying up as we find better and more responsible ways to meet our energy needs. So I think that backdrop is just important because the urgency of reducing coal use everywhere is so great. Now to the economic argument, we have Dr. Thomas Power, who Joel referred to earlier, former chair of the economics department at the University of Montana, has done an economic modeling of this very question and come up with a very different conclusion. His conclusion is that this export, because it undercuts the market, because it provides a cheaper and deeper source of coal to the Chinese market, will increase consumption. That's a basic, you know, sort of economic tenet. As the price goes down and the supply goes up, then demand goes up. We believe that it will also have a very important long-term effect. The question that this coal answers is not where will China get coal to burn tomorrow? As the professor argues, there's a lot of different answers to that question. The question is, what kind of energy infrastructure will they build for the next 40 or 50 years? And they do have choices. They have choices about how much coal, how much gas, how much nuclear, how much renewables they do.
So you want to force them to make the right choice?
Not force at all. But we feel that if we take actions that provide extremely cheap coal from public land in the U.S., introduce that into that market, depress prices in that market, it is more likely that they will build more coal-fired power plants that continue to produce carbon dioxide for 30 or 40 years and make it impossible for the globe to respond to the climate crisis.
Okay, let me go back to Frank Rolock, our professor at Stanford. How do you respond on two issues, one the economic and the other the moral?
I really can't respond to the moral issue simply because I certainly agree that there is a climate challenge that needs to be solved. My only point is just that prohibiting exports of Powder River Basin coal to China, if anything, does nothing to solve it, and as well probably could make it worse. And then on the economic question, if the world supply of coal is so price elastic, meaning that essentially there is so much coal available at the price that China pays for imports, that essentially the Powder River Basin imports to China are essentially would have almost no effect on the global price. I mean, that's one of the things we at the research institute that I is that we actually have a global coal model, and we've actually looked at this issue extensively, and the price impacts of exporting Powder River Basin coal, precisely because it is so cheap, are largely minimal. So, and the other is just simply China has significant, it certainly recognizes the problem and is attempting to build as many power plants as it can build. But the thing is that coal is plentiful in the world, and it's inexpensive, and China has economic development
okay.
goals, so they are still going to stick with coal for quite some time.
We don't have Dr. Thomas Power from the University Powell, I guess it is, from the University of Montana, and we don't have any time left to discuss the economics. But would you concede, Professor Wallach, that there is dispute about the economics?
I think that if you look at the graph, at the actual data, what you see
okay.
is China's greenhouse gases continuing to grow, the United States declining largely because of this coal to gas switching, and I think those mechanisms work. The big question is what happens with can the United States, which is a very small share of the global market for coal, impact the price in such a way to get China to change what it's doing? I think that's really hard to argue.
Joel Connolly, quickly, we have only about a minute left. What's the process now that has to be gone through? And in addition to this one plant we've talked about at Cherry Point, are there others as well one port. Are there others as well?
There is a second major port in play, and that is down in Longview on the Columbia River, where there is a proposal that the coal export port would take over an ancient aluminum smelter, one that actually had pictures of Franklin Roosevelt going through it during the war, and clean that up. It's a major brownfield project, and turn that into an export port.
So how long is this going to take?
I would imagine that we probably will not have a full decision until about 2016. The lawyering will be long and furious.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it at that. Joel Connolly, again, a former national correspondent, now columnist at theseattlepi.com. Thanks to you. Thanks to Laurie Hennessy with the Alliance for Northwest Jobs and Exports, Coalition of Coal Companies, Rail Operators, Unions, Business Groups, and others. Casey Golden with Climate Solutions, Clean Economy Organization based in the Northwest and part of the Power Past Coal Coalition, and Frank Wallach, Professor of Economics, Director of the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University. When L. Ron Hubbard founded Scientology, he hoped to recruit such figures as Walt Disney and Marlene Dietrich and Jackie Gleason. A new book reports on the church and its continued relationship with Hollywood. In a moment, we'll hear from the author on To the Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Kim Masters is host of The Business, syndicated by our mother station, KCRW, in Santa Monica, as are we. She recently sat down with Lawrence Wright, a Pulitzer Prize winner, whose latest book is called Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Here's an excerpt from that interview.
I want to start by laying some groundwork so that, because a lot of people, even though people sort of have this notion about Scientology, you spend a lot of time in your book setting the groundwork of what,
right,
how Scientology came to be. And, you know, you portray the founder of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, as a bigamist, as a wife beater, as one of the most amazing liars who invented all sorts of stories about his experience in World War II and his degrees in nuclear physics and all. And when you write it and people read it, it becomes very difficult for people for me as a reader. You say, I cannot believe that anyone would follow this guy to the corner grocery, much less in the creation of this religion. So what do you attribute that to? Obviously, charisma.
Well, yeah, he was a prototypical charismatic leader of a new religion, and he was a spellbinding character. He had a special talent for bringing young people, in particular, under his spell. And, he had a narrative of his own life, which to some extent may have been fabricated, about being a heroic figure in the war, how he had been blinded and crippled by his wounds and had healed himself. Because at a point where real medicine had not been able to take care of him. And this was a very compelling narrative in post-war America. The therapeutic culture was just beginning to take root, and he wrote this book, Dianetics, in which he proposed that you can solve your own problems, your neuroses and fears yourself, just by reading this book. Boy, it swept the country. It dominated the New York Times bestseller list for a long time, and it really became the prototype for so many of the self-help books that followed.
Yes, and he had been an extraordinarily prolific science fiction writer. And it felt to me, that he at some point because Scientology theory involves a galactic warlord, Xenu, and billions of years ago, bringing these souls that he calls Thetans to the planet Earth and blowing them up in volcanoes. All of this saga feels a lot like science fiction, except, I don't know, maybe at some point he started to be confused himself, do you think, about what he actually made up and what he believed?
Kim, I think that he believed it. I know a lot of people think he's a fraud and a con man. But if that were the case, at some point he would have taken the money and run. Instead, he spent virtually all of his time, all of the days he had to live, exploring this inner landscape of his, writing about the cosmology that he was inventing and the bureaucracy he was creating to sustain it.
Now, the basis of Scientology in some ways is the idea of going clear, ridding your spirit of burdens from past events, from this life or previous lives, Thetans, which are spirits that have been roaming the planet, implanting themselves in your body. And correct me if I'm misstating any of this, because...
No, you're doing pretty well so
thank
far,
you.
Kim.
And the way that you then become what is called an operating Thetan is through auditing. And auditing, well, why don't you describe that?
Auditing is a kind of therapy that Scientology practices. The difference between that and the usual experience of therapy is that between you and the therapist, who's called an auditor in Scientology, there is a machine called an e-meter. And if you're being audited, you hold these two metal cans. In the early days, they were Campbell's soup cans that had the labels stripped off. And they're connected with electrical wires to a meter, and a small current runs through it. And what it actually measures is your galvanic skin response. It's really one-third of a lie detector.
Right, it's like an element of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But according to Scientology, what it measures is your thinking, the mass of, they think that thoughts have mass, and that actually the e-meter measures the movement of that mass. In any case, just imagine that if you are in a therapy session and you're on a lie detector, how that would change the equation. If you believe in the validity of this meter, the e-meter, then you can be led into some pretty novel and sometimes perhaps dangerous back alleys. For instance, many people in auditing remember past lives, past existences. And when they have these memories, they may not have very much substance at the beginning, but the e-meter tells them they're true.
When you are audited, and this is kind of a key element to the celebrity element, I think, of Scientology, you are asked specifically pretty much to name any deed you've done, especially if it might be embarrassing or illegal, cause problems for you if it were known widely.
Absolutely. These confessions are essential to the auditing process. And according to some of the former members I've talked to, you know, many of these sessions are recorded and they go on file. And if you turn against the church, they can be used against you.
So they've got quite a dossier on their members.
They do, on everybody.
Turning to this issue again of celebrity, the idea of pursuing celebrities originated with L. Ron Hubbard.
Yes, it was from the very beginning. They established the church in Los Angeles, and Hollywood was always something that he was interested in. He was an aspiring screenwriter himself, and he constantly courted people that would be helpful to the church. They published a list of prospective Scientology prospects such as Marlene Dietrich and Walt Disney and Jackie Gleason and Bob Hope and Howard Hughes, people like that.
Groucho Marx, I think, was on that list.
He wanted an avatar, a star that could be Scientology's representative in the world, an exemplary figure. But there was always on the horizon the idea that one of these great stars would become a member of the Church of Scientology, and that would allow the church to take over the entire movie entertainment industry.
Now, David Miscavige is the head of the Church of Scientology, and he's very close to one of the church's biggest stars, Tom Cruise. Can you tell me a little bit about their relationship?
They each came to prominence at an extraordinary young age, at a time when their peers were all, you know, apprenticing in their professions, you know, at the age of 25. Essentially, Miscavige was in charge of the church, and Tom Cruise was the biggest movie star in the world. So there weren't very many people like them, and I think there was a great sense of recognition in the two of them.
Of course, ironically, Cruise has also brought some of the most negative attention to Scientology. I mean, you can publish any number of things about Scientology, but when you bring up Tom Cruise, it becomes viral.
Yes, that's true. You know, but Tom's also suffered because of his relationship with the church. I think that he and other celebrity members of Scientology really suffer a kind of public relations martyrdom because of their religious beliefs. So you can say that, you know, Scientology is a network to stardom, as many people in Hollywood like to say. But the truth is, I think that it's really a very difficult cross to bear for so many of these people.
Now, let's just talk a little bit about the process here. When you wrote the New Yorker article that was the kicking off of this book, that's about Paul Haggis's defection from Scientology, you had to do extensive fact-checking. You sent over 900 questions, I think, to the church, and they responded by showing up with 47 binders and a team of lawyers.
All right. It was an epic day. It was probably one of the most interesting moments in my entire journalistic career. In these 47 volumes were responses to the 971 fact-checking queries. But moreover, you know, what I regarded them in as when I looked at these binders all lined up, 7 linear feet, this was a book.
Journalists who wrote about Scientology back in the day were the biggest cautionary tale is Paulette Cooper, whose life was absolutely upended. She was sued, I think, 19 times and framed and indicted and terrible. That was a long time ago. And the church has disavowed some of these tactics, but they certainly they haven't sued anybody in quite a number of years either. They used to sue media outlets and other adversaries, that perceived adversaries, routinely. But what about now? I mean, there's certainly a quick hand with the lawyer letter, and I'm sure you could paper your office with some of those, right?
Yes, indeed. Plenty of legal threats.
How concerned are you?
I don't think about those things. I feel like if you dwell too much on what might happen, you can't really do your job. And you know, my last book was about Al-Qaeda. So, you know, Scientology, for all its ills, is not a terrorist organization. And, you know, I think this story is an ideal story for an investigative reporter. There are all these allegations. There's a lot of confusion. There are charges flying back and forth, and the government seems paralyzed and unable to do anything. So what else is there but an opportunity for an investigative reporter to go in and try to find out what really happens there?
Well, you say the government's paralyzed, and it's been, of course, hugely important to Scientology to have a tax exemption as a religious organization,
yeah,
which was granted in a somewhat unorthodox way by the IRS some years ago. Why is the government to this day paralyzed?
What happened was that the church campaigned vigorously for a tax exemption, which would give them the vast protections of the First Amendment guarantees of freedom of religion. And in the process of that campaign, they launched more than 2,400 lawsuits against the IRS and individual members of that agency, completely crippling the effectiveness of the IRS. It's astonishing to think about, you know, one rather small organization having that kind of effect on an American agency. And part of the deal that was worked out in 1993 was that those suits would be dropped, and they were. And the government recognized Scientology as a religion, and as a consequence, many of the practices that seemed so alarming and even illegal to many Americans, actually protected by the First Amendment, and have been noted so by courts. So Scientology is, as I said, surrounded by lawyers, very carefully controlled in that way, and has lots of money to defend itself.
Lawrence Wright is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and writer for The New Yorker magazine. His latest book is Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. And thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, Kim. Thank you.
Again, Kim of the Kim Masters of the Business. You can hear the entire interview, read a four-page letter from the church calling Wright's book riddled with mistakes, unfounded statements, and utterly false and unsupportable facts. That's at kcrw.com/Scientology. Producers of To the Point, Christian Bordahl, Anna Scott, Katie Cooper, Francis Anderton, and Evan George, and Caitlin Schamberg. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point.
Public Radio International.